This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The discovery of Lucy was a transformative event. It is a turning point in paleoanthropology. And we are all here, Lucy's children, and there is many of us, 8 billion people. But Lucy's immediate children, meaning the juveniles, were extremely rare due to preservation and taphonomic bias. That's the discovery of the Dikika child, which you see here, I would say was an important event as well in paleoanthropology. So today I'll discuss the significance of the Dikika child and highlight our work at Dikika. But before that, I want to thank IHO faculty, staff, and the board for bringing us here together. I want to specifically thank Don, Bill, and Johannes for their successive leadership. They are my good friends for over 30 years. And it's really great to see that IHO continues to be in good hands. And as you can see, as I said earlier, I am sort of part of the family. You can see the Ruskins here. You can see our meeting long time ago, if you remember, Don, our younger version of us, the late Charlie Lockwood, the late Bill Kimball. So things change, and we miss them. So I would say again, thank you, Don, and thank you, Johannes, for doing the great work that you do. Before the discovery of Lucy, our knowledge of Australopithecus, as indicated by Don and Ian, came exclusively from South Africa, represented by Australopithecus africanus. And that is the type species of the genus Australopithecus. Earliest hominins were dated to around 2 million years, and their relationship was pretty simple. By and large, the focus of the time was figuring out the antiquity and taxonomy of the few species that they had. Lucy demonstrated that bipedalism and hominins were older than 3 million years. That's a whopping 1 million years older than previously thought. And this was, of course, transformative. Still a relatively simple family tree was put forward by Johansson and White in 1979, with afferences giving rise to all later hominins, which I think holds. Yes, we can have a debate on that, even though the patterns are more complex. But I think what is unique and a transformation also is now when we discuss about our differences, we don't fight. We respect each other, even though the discussions are fierce. And that is an important transition, I think, from 30, 40 years ago. But when we talk of afferences, it's not all about Lucy, of course. But Lucy inspired more projects and more discoveries. And more fossils from Hadar triggered more questions. And new issues and new questions on the number of species from Hadar and the role of arboreality in Australopithecus afferensis became both prominent but contentious issues. And yet, the new debates also inspire more lab and field research. So the circle is complete. And that led to the proliferation of field projects in the Awash Valley, particularly, and research at Gona, Middle Awash, Lady Gararu, Waranzo Mile, Dikika, our projects that is, in many ways was inspired by previous work, including the discovery of Lucy, and that is a huge impact. Now, let's discuss how our project, Dikika, contributed to improving our knowledge. Dikika is located next to the Lucy site, not far, just across from the Awash River. You can see the Siddhakumatav, it conspicuously represents a band of volcanic ash. And the Dikika child, also known as Salam, was discovered at the site It is a 2.5-year-old girl who lived 3.2 million years ago, which is 150,000 years before Lucy. In addition to the complete skull, it contains many postcranial elements. You can see it here. Both shoulder blades, the clavicles, the hyoid bone, the vertebrae, the foot, and more. It is thus the earliest and most complete juvenile child ever discovered. So, question is, what did we learn from it? Well, I'll answer that question, but before that, let's look at how we determine the age of death and sex of the Dikika child. One major progress in paleoanthropology since the discovery of Lucy is the employment of novel imaging and visualization techniques that provide unprecedented information about early hominins, including the precise age of death of juvenile individuals like the Dikika child. We particularly employed the synchrotron technology to explore the pattern of dental development, which you can see on the video, and also to virtually slice the teeth without destroying the original material, so we can count the daily growth lines in order to determine the age of death. And Gary Schwartz, if here, can tell you more about that. It's based on that technique that we know that the child died at the age of 2.4 years. And the small canine, which you can see there, suggests that it was a girl. Collecting this type of data would have been unthinkable not long ago, much less when Lucy was discovered. So, question is, what are the major significances of this child? Well, the first is that because the type specimen of the Australopithecus africanus is the Tong child, a juvenile, now we can compare apples and apples, meaning we can compare the Dikika child with the Tong child and see how they differ. And when we do that, we see that the Dikika child was different from the Tong child and belongs to the species Australopithecus afarensis. That's significance number one. Number two, there is this issue of ontogeny, meaning as you grow older, you change. As you can see, the chimpanzee here is very different from the adult version. It has a jutting face, the adult one. It will have a big canine, many. But if you look at Don 50 years ago, and now he didn't really change much. Maybe you think he changed, but he did not change much. I don't think he has a jutting face. He doesn't have a big canine. We can check that later. But he did not change much. So humans really don't change much. So the question now is, what was happening in Australopithecus afarensis? And when you find specimens like this, it completes the family, meaning you have the adult male, female, and the child. But we can also ask more complex and sophisticated questions. For example, was there childhood, meaning was there extended dependence of juveniles on grown-ups and adults in Australopithecus afarensis? This is a behavioral question, so it's a complex question, of course. To answer this question, we explored the brain developmental patterns using CT scanning. It really allows you to go deep into the skull without damaging the fossils. You can go further and remove the bones, and you can see that the teeth are here, the brain is here, the endocast is here. Even the inner ear, that's the semicircular canals, are preserved. So what we found is that by age 2.4, the brain size of this individual was 250 cc. And this is only 68% of the adult value in Australopithecus afarensis, which means that the brain was still growing. And that means, though the brain was small, as in apes, Australopithecus afarensis had a protracted or slow brain development similar to what you see in humans. We interpret this to suggest the presence of some type of rudimentary childhood or extended dependence of juveniles on adults and on adults and grown-ups. That is, significance number three. Let's go look at some other questions. Did Australopithecus climb trees? Well, why am I asking that question? Because when you look at this video, this is Lucy, a human and chimp. Some features are human-like, some features are chimp-like. So no one is, of course, questioning whether Lucy or afarensis was bipedal. Hands down, that's clear. But the mix of derived and primitive skeleton in the small brain bipedal and otherwise bipedal creature raises questions. Does it mean that this ape-like feature suggests the ability for climbing trees continued to have a survival value, or were they just ancestral retentions? Well, this debate is not my debate. It is a 40 years old debate. But I think now we have ways to tackle it head on, rather than have a polarized conversation where one is on this end, the other is. There are people who still don't speak to each other because of this debate. And as I said, we are past that. So, what is interesting about the Dikika skeleton, in addition to the information that comes from Lucy and other skeletons, it adds more primitive ape-like features. Number one, the long and curved fingers. Number two, the mobile big toe, which is also primitive in some sense. And the semicircular canal is also very ape-like, meaning the anterior and the posterior canals are not as developed as in humans, where you need that when you have a head and a shoulder, which is decoupled. So it is pertinent to the way of movement that you engage in. Bottom line, the semicircular canal is ape-like, and it's the case in the adult Africanus and afarensis as well. But more prominent is the shoulder blade or the scapula, which is here, is very gorilla-like, different from a human and a chimp. But particularly, the shoulder joint is pointing upwards, which is common in climbing apes, such as chimpanzees. You can see it's pointing, the shoulder joint is pointing upwards in gorillas, chimpanzees, but humans, our shoulder joint is facing sideways. So all that combined, therefore, suggests to me that there was climbing in Australopithecus afarensis. And I don't think that should come as a surprise, because African apes are mostly arboreal when young, but mostly terrestrial or knuckle walkers when older. And yet they never give up, they never abandon climbing in the trees. As you can see, even when they're very large gorillas, they do climb. Why? Well, to feed themselves into a nest. So what may have happened, in my view, in Australopithecus afarensis is that Australopithecus afarensis was climbing at least as much as African apes do for nesting, for feeding, and avoiding predators. But on the ground, they walked. So the analog is they were climbing like the chimps do, the gorillas do, but when they are on ground, they're not knuckle walking, they are walking on two legs. Now, let me ask a different question, because the information comes from Dikika, and my colleague Curtis Marion is involved in this research. And that is, I'm asking the question, did Australopithecus use tools? Well, some cut-marked bones from this site of Dikika, where the only known species is Australopithecus afarensis, suggest that the answer is yes. These marks that you may not be able to see here, but they were, you can see them here maybe, we think were induced by an early hominin that was wielding sharp-edged stone tools to carve meat of the bone, or also break open the bone to access the bone marrow. That's our claim. I don't have time to go into details, but we made a major claim back in 2010, where we said that evidence for stone tool use assisted consumption of animal tissue before 3.4 years ago existed at Dikika, and the only species at the site is afarensis, therefore afarensis was using tools. And following that, 5 years after, our colleagues in Kenya led by Sonia Armand, found these stone tools they named Lomaquian stone tools. Whether they were made by the same species or not, I don't know. But there is something older than 3 million years evidence in forms of cut marked bones from the Kika and the stone tools from Lomaqui, suggesting that indeed we have some form of stone tool use or even making dating back to 3.3 million years ago. And the species around that time, and the Kika is Afarensis, and in Kenya it is Kenyanthropus pladiops. For me, it's Australopithecus pladiops, but it doesn't matter. But an Australopithecus-like creature is able to do stone tools. So I would say, therefore, that while more work and evidence is needed, stone tool use and making in Australopithecus-like hominin is not a surprise. Data on primate behavior, capuchins and chimpanzees do that. Early hominin hand morphology, I'm sure Tracy will speak on this. Taphonomy, Jessica will speak on this also. They can say different things, that's fine. Dictate that we reevaluate our theoretical framework. I think the takeaway from here for me is not the cuts. We have to think beyond the cuts, beyond the rocks, and really evaluate, reevaluate our theoretical framework, whereby we consider the origin and the evolution of stone tool technology in our lineage, meaning Homo habilis, for me, was not the only handy human out there. So in summary, therefore, what is the current status of the Lucy species? What picture do I have personally of the species based on the new information? And I have given you at least 5 new information, more or less, based on the work that we've done. Well, for me, the Lucy species was a biped climber, had a small brain with a protracted development, suggesting some type of dependence of juveniles, which is extended. It was a tool user, consumed considerable amount of grass-based diet, as we know it from C3C4 studies, meaning stabilized sub-studies, but supplemented with animal resources thanks to the stone tools that are being wielded by these early hominins. The use of stone tools and meat consumption could be sporadic, so we cannot expect at this time to have as abundant stone tools and cut marks bones as we have them much later, because that behavior would have to evolve. And the paper actually led by Jessica Thompson, published in Current Anthropology, outlines this beautifully. And these creatures, as Kay will tell you, hopefully she agrees, lived in mosaic and woodland environments. And more importantly, they gave rise to the genus Homo, meaning Australopithecus afarensis is our ancestor. The Lucy species is our ancestor, so I claim. Finally, what was the impact of Lucy? Well, as Don says all the time, and he's right, she serves as a benchmark for subsequent discoveries. Hence, larger than Lucy, smaller than Lucy, bigger than Lucy, smaller than Lucy, etc. She was a big inspiration for more fieldwork. We will agree. I was inspired in many ways because of the discovery of Lucy and discoveries made at Hadar. Inspires children. Children, even my own kids. And you can see the late Bill Kimball watching us from at the back. To do science, but also to get involved in paleoanthropology. Inspiration for institutional development. I think IHO is a very good example of this one. Public awareness and human evolution, but also a tool to inspire policymakers, including President Obama when he visited Addis. I had the opportunity and privilege to speak with him for about 20, 30 minutes. And I'm asking him on that picture to touch the vertebra of that bone. And actually, a journalist asked, shouldn't that be a privilege of only scientists? And I told him, well, this is an extraordinary specimen, and he's an extraordinary person, so extraordinary people deserve extraordinary access. I hope, Don, you're not mad at me. You are extraordinary also. And actually, it really makes the conversation very easy because I'm a member of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And when I was introduced to the Pope, the guy who was introducing me was using Lucy. He is this guy, discovered this child, blah, blah, who belongs to Lucy. So you cannot ignore the significance of Lucy, even when you speak in some of the unusual places. With that, I want to say two things, actually just one. And that is about Lucy again. Lucy, of course, belongs to the species Australopithecus and is a 40% complete skeleton. But I want to really recognize Don Johansson, because Lucy is not just the find that he'd made in 1974, which started with the Ulna, I think. Lucy was not just also about the naming of species Australopithecus, and the two are monumentally important. But Lucy, we owe it to the amount of time, patience, and perseverance that Don Johansson put into making her Lucy, the Lucy that we know, would not have been the Lucy that we know unless Don had the passion and the perseverance, and I would like to recognize that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.